What specific threats to the global climate system are posed by melting ice and the release of methane from the Arctic? Do the recommendations put forward at the recent UN Climate Summit in Lima, Peru, go far enough in addressing the climate threat from a greenhouse gas 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide? What are the merits of attempting a limited geoengineering strategy that might prevent or delay the Arctic melt? Why is there so much resistance from right-wing politicians to prominent environmental organizations to confronting the severity of the looming climate catastrophe? Is there a tipping point in human behavior that might prevent the biggest catastrophe our species has ever faced? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we continue last week's conversation on climate change with Paul Beckwith, climate scientist who attended the recent COP20 conference, and with investigative journalist and climate researcher Dar Jamail. On this week's program, Confronting Climate Catastrophe, conversations with Paul Beckwith and Dar Jamail. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 19th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Here's what's happening. Washington has persuaded the Saudis to flood the market with oil to push down prices, decimate Russia's economy, and reduce Moscow's resistance to further NATO encirclement and the spreading of U.S. military bases across Central Asia. The U.S.-Saudi scheme has slashed oil prices by nearly a half since they hit their peak in June. The sharp decline in prices has burst the bubble in high-yield debt, which has increased the turbulence in the credit markets while pushing global equities into a tailspin. The U.S. must achieve its objectives in Central Asia or forfeit its top spot as the world's only superpower. There's simply no other way to sustain the status quo, which allows the U.S. to impose its own coercive dollar system on the world, a system in which the U.S. exchanges paper currency produced at will by the central bank for valuable raw materials, manufactured products, and hard labor. That comes from the article, The Oil Coup, U.S.-Saudi Subterfuge, Send Stocks and Credit Reeling, by Mike Whitney, posted December 17th, originally appearing in Counterpunch. So, now, both the Senate and the House, plus the U.S. President, via his State Department, CIA, FBI, and entire administration, are actually at war, a hot war, not a cold war, against Russia, through their proxy, their made-in-Washington racist, fascist, or Nazi government of Ukraine, which currently is doing the fighting and the killing and the dying, but which couldn't do it but for that Western backing. This should be analogized to Fidel Castro's takeover of Cuba and Soviet leader Khrushchev's attempt to base near the U.S. Soviet nuclear missiles aimed against America. At that time, in 1962, U.S. President John Fitzgerald Kennedy said that we'd go to war against the USSR if necessary to prevent this. And today, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has implied, but not yet said, that his country will likewise go to war against the United States if necessary to stop its attempt to do against Russia what Khrushchev had been stopped from doing against the U.S. in 1962. Ukraine is today's Cuba, but even more of a danger. And this time, the United States government is trying to impose nuclear supremacy, the Soviet Union and its communism no longer even exist, and Russia is up against the mortal threat that is being wrongfully perpetrated by the U.S. against them. Well, that comes from the article, Washington Seeks an Excuse to Wage a Nuclear War on Russia. We're Close to the Precipice, Will the Public Remain Silent? By Eric Zeus, posted December 17th. Both WW1 and WW2 had two dimensions, the vertical dimension, namely the rivalry between empires, and the horizontal one, class warfare, Powells explains. These wars were actually the best way for the Western elite to cope with the ever-growing revolutionary and democratic movements fueled by dire economic conditions and which threatened the established order. Communism and socialism were gaining worldwide momentum after WW1. Quote, the German industrial and financial elite wished to crush the revolutionary movement and destroy the Soviet Union. Adolf Hitler was their instrument, unquote. That comes from the article Fascism and War, Elite Tools to Crush and Kill Dissent by Julie Levesque, posted December 17th. A previous article discussed Russian economist, political analyst Mikhail Delyagin expecting a possible anti-Russian nuclear false flag. Fort Rus now cites intelligence about impending terrorist attacks on Ukrainian strategic objects, which will justify an attack on Donbass. Foreign nationals and relatives of senior Ukrainian officials were evacuated from border areas, it says. Armored vehicles with Russian and Donetsk People's Republic symbols and flags were seen in Donbass territory controlled by Ukraine's military. Other intelligence, quote, confirmed the arrival of large numbers of mercenaries, equipment, and machinery from NATO countries, unquote. That comes from the article America Confronts Russia, Kiev Anti-Russian False Flag Planned by Stephen Lendman, posted December 17th. Known and documented, the ongoing dumping of highly radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean constitutes a potential trigger to a process of global radioactive contamination. This water contains plutonium-239, and its release into the ocean has both local as well as global repercussions. A recent report suggests that the Japanese government is intent upon releasing the remaining radioactive water into the ocean. The proposed solution becomes the cause of radioactive contamination of both the Japanese coastline as well as the Pacific Ocean, extending to the coastline of North America. While the chairman of the Nuclear Radiation Authority recognizes that the water in the tanks is heavily tainted, a decision has nonetheless been taken to empty the tanks and dump the water into the ocean. That comes from the article, The Fukushima Endgame, The Radioactive Contamination of the Pacific Ocean, by Professor Michel Chosudovsky, posted December 17th. While the absurd request for an IS flag during the course of an act of violence being committed by a Shiite Muslim is enough to convince the average spectator that Monus was a member of ISIS, there is a distinct lack of consistency in the way in which Monus has been portrayed in the Western media. Nearly 10 years ago, Monus was presented as a quote-unquote liberal Muslim, preaching a brand of tolerant and mainstream Islam. Since 2013, however, Monus has been presented as both a murderer and now a terrorist. While the latter may certainly be true, the presentations are nonetheless contradictory. Indeed, as Tony Cartolucci of Land Destroyer reports in his article, Who Created Cartoon Character Man-Heron Monus Behind Sydney Siege Crisis, Monus has spoken glowingly of the West in the past, Canada, the United States, and Australia in particular. That comes from the article, Five Reasons to Question the Official Story of the Sydney Siege, by Brandon Turbeville, posted December 17th, originally appearing at Activist Post. A Ukrainian soldier who was part of the crew that operated the supposed missile battery that the Ukrainian government claims shot down the Malaysian MH17 airliner on July 17th, has testified publicly for the first time, saying that the missile battery was operated by the Ukrainian military, not by the rebels, as asserted, and that he and his former crewmates who operated it laughed when they heard their government say that this missile battery was operated by rebels and had shot the airliner down. An English translated transcript of the December 15th Russian language interview with this soldier was posted at ukrainewar.info on December 17th by Michael Collins, an investigative journalist with ukrainewar.info, who had been following very closely the multiple investigations that are proceeding into the cause of the downing. This testimony confirms the accumulating prior, already overwhelming, and even more convincing evidence, which is linked to in my latest article on the topic here, all of which evidence indicates that either one or else two Ukrainian fighter jets intentionally shot this airliner down. That was not an error by rebels who had misidentified this airliner as being a bomber from the Ukrainian government, such as the Ukrainian government and its sponsor, the U.S. government, claim. Regarding the reason why the Ukrainian government did this, it, too, is clear. U.S. President Obama needed a startling incident in order to obtain from the EU and other U.S. allied nations their participation in heavily increased economic sanctions to weaken Russia. This false flag event, as such government fakeries are called in the intelligence communities, succeeded, just as did Hitler's burning down the Reichstag and blaming it on leftists, which was the event that enabled him to seize total power in Germany. That comes from the article, Ukrainian Soldier Confirms Ukraine's Military Shot Down Malaysian MH17 Plane by Eric Zeus, posted December 18th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Last Sunday, December 14th, the UN Climate Conference concluded with a climate plan that, for the first time, commits all countries to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. Paul Beckwith is a climatologist and part-time professor at the University of Ottawa. He is also part of a group of scientists and activists called the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, or AMEG. He was present at the COP20 conference and is preparing to highlight the extent of the climate predicament we face and whether there is hope that these or other initiatives hold any prospect for rescuing our world from runaway global warming. So, Paul Beckwith, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research NewsHour.
Well, thank you for having me today, Michael.
You started from an engineering physics background and you took an interest in climate science. How did that come about?
The first degree I did was a Bachelor of Engineering in engineering physics, and then I liked the physics side more than the engineering side, so I did a master's degree in laser physics, and then worked in that field for many years. But over the years, I've become increasingly concerned about the very rapid changes that have been occurring in the weather patterns and the climate system. So I've been following, I think I've been reading IPCC reports pretty much since they started, being produced in the early 90s. And in the last, say, 5 or 6 years, I've thought that from my reading and so on and paying attention to climate change, that things were deteriorating quickly, that we're getting lots more weather extremes in terms of torrential rains, floods, droughts, and things like that. So I decided to go back to university and research sort of abrupt climate change, just to see how quickly can the climate change. How quickly has it changed in the past, in the paleo records, for example, in the ice core records or the marine sediment records? How fast can the temperature rise over the globe? And I've been looking more deeply into the contemporary, changes, the changes in the Arctic sea ice and snow cover, increases of methane emissions and so on. and trying to look at the, so I mean, my research is looking at the overall climate system, which is sort of the opposite to what most people in the university, how they work. Most people, they study a very specific, narrow research topic, and they try to advance the science in that topic, and they kind of lose track of the overall system. So I'm trying to do the complete opposite. I'm trying to look at the overall system to see how it's changing, to see how the cascading feedbacks occur, and to see, you know, like the whole hypothesis of my research is that I think that we are undergoing early stages of an abrupt climate change right now, and I'm trying to, you know, either prove or disprove this with my research.
Now, Paul Beckwith, I mean, we spoke with Guy McPherson last week. I mean, he outlined a lot of very, I guess, depressing points, but of course he talks about these what he called self-reinforcing feedback loops, and one of the, you know, he in particular he mentioned a lot of the research that's being done by you and your colleagues with the with AMEG, this whole idea of methane gas, like the warmer it gets, the more we see methane being released from the North Pole, and how that just accelerates the climate predicament we're in. Maybe you could just, you know, help reinforce that point. I mean, how severe, how serious is that one aspect of this problem?
Yes. So just in a nutshell, I mean, the Arctic, the Arctic's getting a lot darker. Like the greenhouse gases are raising the overall temperature, and when you raise the overall temperature, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere because there's more evaporation. And different parts of the planet warm at different rates. So the Arctic, because of all the snow and ice there that is melting and being replaced by darker surfaces, either permafrost on the land or ocean water, you know, for the sea ice case, so the whole region is darkening. So the absorption of solar radiation is much greater. So if you look at regions in the high Arctic, then the average temperature rise over the per decade is about 5 to 8 times faster than the global average. And the global average I'm talking about is the global average over many decades. I'm not talking about the reduced average that has occurred over the for the atmosphere over the last 10 to 15 years, which is highlighted quite a bit by climate change deniers. And there's reasons for that, because the heat is distributed between the ocean and the atmosphere, and the ocean has been taking a lot more of that heat and warming, and we'll return it back to the atmosphere over time, but there's a bit of a lag there. So, but because the Arctic is warming that much more quickly than, say, the equator, and this is key, it's not that 2-degree temperature threshold that the IPCC is talking about continuously that's important. What's important is that temperature difference between the rapidly warming Arctic and the equator, because that is reducing. As the North is warming very rapidly, it reduces that difference between the equator. And that is very significant, because that temperature difference creates a pressure difference, which leads to the atmospheric circulation patterns that we're used to. Like the jet streams that are formed are because of that temperature difference and the air moving, hot air moving from the equator poleward. So when that temperature difference decreases, as it is, it's the jet streams slow down. There's less hot air moving from the equator northward because the Arctic's warming by itself. So the jet streams slow down, become wavier, and because there's a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere from the warmer temperature, there's a lot more energy in the atmosphere. So we get these torrential rain events, and we get these droughts in other areas, and the storm systems move more slowly. And the jet stream acts as kind of a wall or barrier between the cold, dry air in the Arctic and the warmer, humid air at the equator. So because these jet streams become very wavy and they have very, very high latitude waves or crests of waves, if you like, and very low latitude troughs, then the weather patterns become less dependent on latitude and more dependent on where you are relative to the jet stream. And if you're in a location that the jet stream passes through, you can have exceptionally warm temperatures for a period of time, and then the wave passes by you from the jet stream, and then you can go into very, very deep cold temperatures.
So the weather
patterns have changed, and because also the methane is crucial, because as the Arctic is warming, parts of the water, ocean water over the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf, are 5 to 7 degrees Celsius warmer than they were before. And these are thawing warming the ocean floor, and the organic matter that is there is being broken down by bacteria into methane and CO2. Methane predominantly for marine sediment, because there's a lack of oxygen. So you get anaerobic decomposition and you get the methane produced. So the Russians have been monitoring methane from the shelf for many, many years. And since about 2010, 2011, they've seen very large increases in both the regions over which the methane is coming up and the quantities of the methane.
So Paul Beckwith, then, I guess we're going to be seeing, because I understand from some of the research that the polar ice caps are essentially melting, so we'll see open sea in the year or two ahead. That's only going to make the situation worse, right?
Yes. See, the problem with if you have a kilogram of sea ice in the Arctic, that will require so much energy to melt that ice and leave you with a kilogram of water at 0 degrees Celsius. And now take that same amount of energy that melted that 1 kilogram of ice and apply it to heating up that water at 0 degrees Celsius, and it raises that water temperature to 80 degrees Celsius. So the ice up there, the snow and ice, acts as a huge sort of sink for the energy. And the energy goes into melting that snow and ice as opposed to raising the temperature. But remove the snow and ice, and that energy goes into raising the temperature. So when the U.S. Naval Graduate School research by Maslowski et al. Uses a regional climate model, and in 2007 their model came up with a number that it was very likely that before the end of, I think their number was 2016. By about 2016, we would likely have this blue ocean event, which is an ocean around in the far north, the Arctic Ocean no longer having ice of any significance, which basically means under a million square kilometers, and that ice would be probably a lot of it would be fast ice around the shores and borders. But basically, so that model was then updated recently, and there was a paper published in 2012 by Maslowski and his group that had a number. Their models were still showing that this was very likely to happen before the end of 2020. Now, the sea ice data that most people look at is area, where you have 100% ice concentration, or extent, where you have at least 15% of the region is ice. And they're looking at that decline. But what's really important is the sea ice volume. So you need to take the thickness data and to get the volume. And a person who's, one of the world's experts, I would say the leading world expert on sea ice in the Arctic, is Peter Wadhams. He's a Cambridge professor. In fact, his office is just across the hallway from Stephen Hawking. And over the last 30 years, he studied the ice in the Arctic, a lot of times from British nuclear submarines during the Cold War, using sonar is pointing upward, measuring the sea ice thickness. And he's very convinced that the Maslowski model is probably going to be close to the mark. Based on his observations, he thinks that the ice will likely be gone in September, near the end of the melt season, before 2020. Now, if that happens, the problem is it takes, the ice will refreeze in the winter, but if it goes, then the ocean water underneath is that much warmer, which does increase the methane coming up. But not only that, the ice takes longer to refreeze in the winter. So the ice gets weaker and weaker as time goes, and within 2 or 3 years of that first blue ocean event, the duration that the blue ocean will occur will increase from, say, a week or two during the initial year or to several months. And within a decade, some of the data indicates that the complete Arctic Ocean will be open water year-round within about a decade or so of that first blue ocean event. And if that occurs, then the melt rates on places like Greenland and other places will increase a lot. And needless to say, this temperature gradient, which sets up the weather circulation patterns, not just in the northern hemisphere, but also in the southern hemisphere, we'll be in a different climate system. We won't recognize what we have.
Runaway global warming.
Well, this is, when people say runaway, I mean, you have to be careful with that term, because they talk about, like, Venus went runaway, for example, got extremely hot and the atmosphere was all CO2. And, I prefer to say more like abrupt climate change, where, we have a global average temperature of, say, 14.5 degrees, 15 degrees before the Industrial Revolution. And after a transition to no sea ice and, much warmer Arctic than we basically have a regime shift to a different state, a much warmer state where there's very little snow and ice in the Arctic, and the jet streams have completely reconfigured, and the northern hemisphere is a lot warmer and so on. But see, this is a global thing. So because there's the Arctic is warming from the increased solar absorption, there's less heat moving there from the equator, because heat moves depending on the temperature difference, hot to cold, and the larger the temperature difference, the more heat moves. And on the Earth, it moves in both the ocean currents and the atmosphere on basically a 1-to-2 ratio. So about a third of the heat will move via the ocean currents from the equator northward, and about two-thirds of the heat carried by the atmospheric wind circulation patterns. So because less heat is moving from the equator northward, more heat moves into the southern hemisphere from the equator. Now, the Antarctic is a very cold, region, so the heat movement southward doesn't reach Antarctica, but it does reach Australia, generating heat waves there, but it does increase the temperature difference between the Australia region and Antarctica, and that temperature difference increases the wind, circumpolar winds and ocean currents that travel around Antarctica. And because the Coriolis force deflects things to the left in the southern hemisphere, that is the main reason I think that the sea ice around Antarctica is growing about 1% or 1.5% per decade. Most scientists have attributed that to freshening of the water and other factors, but I think that's the main reason. I think the Arctic warming is changing global patterns, including causing increases in Antarctica sea ice.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. as I mentioned at the outset, you were at the UN Climate Conference in Lima, Peru over the last 2 weeks. Did you get any sense that the concerns that you've been raising on this program and on the Arctic, on your blog, that the world leaders and even environmental groups are taking it seriously and addressing it in any serious way?
In a nutshell, the answer is no. The IPCC report, you generally... there's a lag time of about 4 years between research being done and anything appearing in a report. Basically, the IPCC documents, they don't consider methane to be a serious threat. They consider, the models show that methane should stay in the sediments, for example, under the seafloor, and it takes hundreds of years for the for heat to transfer through the sediments to release methane. But observations are showing differently. There's, you know, you don't have a perfect slab seafloor. You have fractures. You have areas of unfrozen permafrost called talix. You have weak spots, and it's where these weak spots are that the methane is perforating through and coming up. So I don't hold weight to any model that is in conflict with observations, and there's plenty of observation by the Russians and other people of methane coming up. A couple of sort of what I see are key points from the IPCC, from this COP20 meeting that are promising. One of them is that many countries are starting to talk about the need to completely decarbonize the economy, so completely get off carbon, almost 100% off carbon. And they're talking about time frames like 2050.
That we're talking about changes happening in before 2020. That's not good enough.
Yes, no, it's not. It's not good enough. I mean, I've thought for many years that there'll be a tipping point in human behavior and understanding on the climate disruption crisis, and we're not there yet. But we're getting closer and closer. What's happening is the extreme weather events around the planet are becoming so in your face, obvious to ever greater numbers of people, that people are getting concerned and worried. You know, when trees start dying in your backyard, you know, when you live in a desert and you get torrential rainfall or snow, when you're in a dry, you know, when you're in California and you have a 1 in 1200 year drought, and then suddenly you get inundated with flash flooding and massive rainfall, this whiplashing of weather extremes. You know, all this is what's really, it's like taking a hammer and banging people on the head saying, wake up, you know. That's what's changing people's views, and that will continue. What my premise is that it's all due to the sea ice and, and decline and the albedo decline in the Arctic. It's destabilizing the climate system. And it's very, you know, it's we're heading to a much warmer planet, which can happen very quickly. And I see this, the extreme, I mean, when you think about the so-called polar vortex from the media, which is a bit of a misnomer, but we're seeing these huge waves where the ridge is carrying huge amounts of heat northward to very high regions, like Alaska's has record temperatures. And then the cold comes down from the Arctic down to Florida and freezes out crops, and you know, it's kind of clear that when you have record, you know, huge amounts of heat moving north to the Arctic, you're heating the Arctic. What people don't recognize is that when you have huge amounts of cold air from the Arctic moving southward, that's also effectively a huge warming of the Arctic, because that cold water that you're moving south is displaced with warmer air. Air and water, you know, in the case of the ocean. So this is a huge feedback. The waviness of the jet stream is an enormous feedback, and it's all working to equalize the temperature in the northern hemisphere to reduce the dependence on latitude. And of course, the jet streams, which depend on that temperature difference, get fractured and wavy, and there's regions that are very fast, regions that are very slow. It basically becomes a very chaotic system. It certainly loses the patterns that we're used to, and this is all happening without huge amounts of methane coming out. Now, methane is crucial because the global warming potential of methane on a molecule per molecule comparison to CO2 is over 150 times over a few-year time scale. And it's the few-year time scale that's important for the Arctic and the sea ice and so on. The number is being used all the time is a 100-year time scale of about, which is up to about 34 or something.
Given the short time frame, I mean, are you any kind of a proponent of geoengineering? Because I know I talked with Guy McPherson last week, and he's dead set against it, arguing that the research indicates that geoengineering will only make things worse. So what are your thoughts about that?
First, I prefer to break it down like geoengineering. I mean, there's two main branches. There's solar radiation management, SRM, which is what people generally think of with geoengineering, that term. I mean, the solar radiation management would be things like, okay, we know when a large volcano goes off on the planet, it sends up, if it sends up ash and gases into the stratosphere above the weather, then it won't be rained out. So it stays up there for several years, and it reflects sunlight and cools the planet. So there's not much sulfur compared to the sulfur coming from a power plant, like a coal-burning power plant, that comes out of the stacks at low altitude, and causes acid rain and some problems with people on the surface. But if you put the sulfur dioxide, a smaller amount than what comes out of these stacks, up into the stratosphere over the Arctic during the summer, then you could reflect light away and cause cooling. Another method that's being used that has very good promise for cooling is to have these towers to create and spray salt water up into the lower atmosphere, like the first 1.5 kilometers or something. And that salt spray would cause marine clouds, which would cause the cooling of that region. So if you did it over regions where water was moving northward, warm water to enter the Arctic, then that would cool that water. So, I mean, we have no choice. We have to slash emissions, because none of these solar radiation management methods, even if they were to work, reduce CO2 levels, which cause the ocean acidification and threaten the whole food chain of the ocean. So those are methods. When people talk about geoengineering, those are the methods that they really talk about. The other type of branch of it is carbon dioxide removal or CDR. And obviously, we've added loads of CO2 to the atmosphere, and methane and nitrous oxide. We've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. We've changed how the atmosphere, the heat trapping properties of the atmosphere. So carbon dioxide removal is first of all, we have to slash emissions, so we're not pumping the atmosphere up with carbon dioxide and these other greenhouse gases. But, can we remove CO2 from the atmosphere? For example, taking areas that were deforested and making huge but vast amounts of forest, that forest plants remove CO2 from the atmosphere. So that's one aspect of carbon dioxide removal. Another aspect would be, we know that rock removes CO2 over very long timescales. So there's some types of rocks and minerals, like olivine, for example. If we grind it up into dust and spread it over various parts of the planet, then this is we can greatly accelerate the speed at which CO2 can be removed from the atmosphere. So that fits under carbon dioxide removal. And people are looking at other ways of removing CO2 or storing carbon. Like, for example, if you take carbon organic matter before it decomposes and you heat it quickly in the absence of water, you can, it's called pyrolysis, then you can create this like charcoal-like material termed biochar. And you can bury it in the soils and increase the fertility of the soils and the productivity of the soils for farming, but trap the carbon. The carbon will stay in the ground for a lot longer. It won't decay because it's in this form. So these are all methods of carbon dioxide removal, which I think we're at the stage that we have to do these things. I mean, we certainly have to slash emissions, global emissions, but I think we have to do these other things. And I think that the lags in the system will keep the Arctic continuing to warm. So I think as a stopgap method, if we were to cool the Arctic, then we would restore this temperature gradient with the equator, and we would restore some of the weather patterns that we're used to, and that would buy us a bit of time to slash the emissions and get these other carbon dioxide removal schemes in underway. So I think that we're at a stage where we actually have to start doing these things as opposed to just talking about the research on them. And this is AMEG's view, and this has been our view since we formed over 3 years ago. We haven't changed our view in any way. We've just been observing the climate system deteriorating further and quicker in ways that we have expected. When the sea ice is gone, I think the weather extremes on the planet will increase 10 or 20 times in frequency, severity, duration, and they'll occur in regions where they weren't occurring before.
Paul Beckwith, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Paul Beckwith is a climatologist and part-time professor at the University of Ottawa. He's also part of the group of scientists and activists called the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, or AMEG. He joins us from Ottawa. Paul Beckwith can be reached through his Twitter handle, paul.h.beckwith. A wealth of information from the Arctic Methane Emergency Group is available at ameg.me. Well, we're speaking right now with Dar Jamail. He's an investigative journalist and staff reporter with Truth Out. He's the author of The Mass Destruction of Iraq, The Disintegration of a Nation, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible. Over the last year, Dar Jamail has placed a particular focus on the climate crisis, what he calls anthropogenic climate disruption, or ACD. He joins us now to help us navigate this clear and present threat facing humanity and all life on Earth from a media perspective. Welcome to the Global Research NewsHour, Dar Jamail.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I guess I wanted to first reference your work as an unembedded reporter during the U.S. occupation of Iraq. I know it made major waves and helped vault you to indie media stardom, as I recall. I was curious as to any lessons you may have learned from that experience and how it informs your current reporting and research into the climate predicament.
It's a good question because I've had a very interesting experience reporting independently from Iraq. And in sum, the first few years from 2003 to 2006, I was reporting on the disintegration of a country, of atrocities and war crimes being carried out by U.S. military personnel against innocent Iraqi civilians. And while doing so, I was attacked vociferously by the right-wing media as well as the establishment corporate press, but surprisingly also a lot of the mainstream left. I was attacked from folks within The Nation magazine, say, oh, this can't be so, and this is too radical, and this kind of thing, and as well as getting death threats via email from people in the military and things like this. And then, 2-3 years later, by late 2006, when it became clear to everyone that this was a disaster and everything I'd reported was spot on, I actually had a lot of people come back and give me apologies and say, yeah, actually, you were right. You know, you were just ahead of the game. And what I'm experiencing now, reporting on how far along we are in regards to climate disruption and the climate crisis and what we've done to the planet, and that we're already off the cliff, and that there really is, you know, any hope that there might be to dramatically mitigate anything, and certainly talking about the impossibility of really changing what's coming, and interviewing people like Paul Beckwith and Guy McPherson and folks that you've, other folks that you've had on your show that are talking about the reality of the situation and how far off the cliff we already are. Once again, I feel like I'm back in Baghdad 2003 by myself, being one of the only people reporting on how out of control the situation already is. And I'm wondering, how long it's going to take the rest of the media to really get and really start reporting accurately how far along we really are. Because right now, it's again, it's just me and a few other voices in the wilderness, so to speak, that are doing it and feeling pretty alone. But at the same time, I feel extremely confident in the facts that I'm reporting and using the most well-vetted scientific sources available, studies published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and reports from NASA and on and on and on. So I'm using the most bulletproof data I can find, and yet still find myself among just very, very few people actually reporting on the reality of the situation.
It's quite incredible. As with the Iraq wars, you're mentioning there's been so much media obfuscation about the science of ACD. You've got, I even have quotes from your one of your pieces about how there are, you know, elected representatives here in the United States. I think one I've got here from Steve King, a congressman from Iowa. It is not proven. It's not science. It's more of a religion than a science. Then there's this other one from the great James Inhofe, senator and former chair of the U.S. Senate Committee on the Environment and Public. The idea that man-made gases, CO2, are causing catastrophic global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people, unquote. So you've got all of that messaging and all that kind of obfuscation. Have you had any success in being able to counter that kind of messaging, or do you just pretty much ignore them at this point?
Well, I think the lunatics, like you just mentioned, that I'm part of my monthly climate dispatch, I always include the most recent amazing antics of denial by the fossil fuel funded corporate media and the puppet politicians. So that's always entertaining, and I certainly am under no illusion that I'm not going to convince anyone of the facts who are dead set against those facts and dead set against wanting to be convinced or wanting to believe what's actually happening. So I think anyone that's engaged in that is frankly wasting their time. You know, it's like that old adage of don't try to teach a pig to sing. You look stupid and it annoys the pig. You know, so that's my perspective on that. And then, the rest of it, though, of reporting, you know, primarily through my dispatches, which are a monthly rundown of, you know, ample evidence across the globe and scientific reports that have come out in that month that show how far along we already are. And that's actually had effect. I mean, I get emails daily almost from people from those dispatches, as well as the other stories I'm doing about methane or the melting of the Arctic ice cap and things along those lines, and get a lot of feedback of people thanking me and saying, yeah, I wasn't aware we were quite that far along. So I do get a lot of positive feedback. And so I think in that way, at least with particularly with Truth Out's readership, which is a pretty substantial readership, pretty well-informed readers, and yet even within that community, I get a lot of people letting me know that they're appreciative of having this information so that then they can have it going about their lives and making better decisions.
Hmm. Now, I mean, I just wanted to bring up further on this point. I don't want to belabor it too much, but, you know, we find that there have been, even in indie media circles, a lot of that denialism. I mean, for example, saying that global warming is driven by the sun, not greenhouse gas emissions, and even suggesting it's all just a plot by the globalists to impose a carbon tax on humanity and enslave us all to the New World Order. I think you know who I'm talking about. I mean, is there some sense in which, you know, indie media, in so far as there's a willingness to question mainstream media, that it's gone to the extent that everything is up for grabs? You know what I mean?
I really point the finger more at the bigger groups like the 350.org and sort of the more mainstream left journalists like Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein of still peddling this idea of hope, and that somehow those in positions of political power can still be pressured to do the right thing. And I think that that's a tremendous waste of resources and attention and time for people to buy those folks' books and go to their talks and really kind of buy that message of what Guy McPherson refers to as hopium, you know, that somehow that there can be some mass movement and we can change this political system and the corporate system, you know, is delusional, frankly. I think there's no other way to put it that, you know, these people who are willing to wipe out an entire country like Iraq or Syria or, you know, conduct the types of things that were just revealed in the CIA report that was just released recently by the Senate, that, you know, you think these people are reasonable and you think that they can somehow be changed or pressured politically to do the right and moral thing is delusional. I think it's just that simple. So I'm critical of that, and I think that people, you know, but the other thing, too, to take a more, I guess, compassionate or diplomatic approach to it is one thing I've been talking about when I give lectures about climate disruption is pointing to the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model of the five stages of grief. You know, some of them, one of the stages is denial. One of the stages of processing grief is bargaining. And so I attribute things like what Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein are doing to as, hey, these are people that are probably in the bargaining stage, because when you really look at how far along we are and the consequences and the possibilities of abrupt climate change and near-term human extinction as being very feasible and very possible, that's a horrific, terrifying thing to take in, and it takes a lot of time for anyone to process that. And so I think it helps for me as an individual living on this planet where it is today to look out at this landscape of, you know, you have the fanatics you mentioned earlier, the far right wing lunatics, you know, giving us these amazing quotes. Well, they're clearly in denial. And then you have people like Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben. Well, they're clearly in the bargaining stage, you know, and the last stage is acceptance. And another one of the stages is anger, you know, and another one of the stages is depression. And so if you look out at the landscape and see how people are talking and accepting this information, it's pretty easy to see which stage of the Kubler-Ross cycle they're in. And so that's just another perspective.
So I think that I would have thought of the Naomi Kleins and the Bill McKibbens as being in denial, just in a different kind of denial. So it's interesting that you talk about them being in the bargaining stage. But do you rule out then any kind of behind the scenes influence on their ability to conceive of the situation, or is this just by talking about this in the context of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's you know, dynamic, is this simply a psychological issue?
I think it's both. I'm glad you brought up the other, because there is, without a doubt, behind-the-scenes influence on folks like this of, you know, where's their bread buttered? You know, where's their funding coming from? And there's well-documented reports out on where 350.org gets its funding and, you know, Bill McKibben and his ties with the mainstream Democratic Party. And you can look at Naomi Klein and who she writes for and who they're funded by. And I'm talking about The Nation magazine and why their opinion on the Iraq war or a Democratic presidential person like Obama or, you know, climate change for that matter, why their perspective is always tempered. And it's never really, they're always afraid to go too far out and put out really radical information, radical being let's get down to the root of what's actually happening, because, you know, they're essentially by and large another arm of the Democratic Party and have deep ties to them. So there absolutely are those financial and political influences behind these folks, as well as looking at where they're at through the Kubler-Ross perspective.
Now, on the subject of bargaining, there is a I would think that there's a tendency in our society, and it's all over popular culture. I mean, look at all the movies that we watch, that, you know, where there's a will, there's a way, and there's got to be some techno fix. And I think a techno fix that has come up is this idea of geoengineering. Of course, Guy McPherson has pointed to the scientific literature and indicated that most geoengineering methods are bound to make things worse, not better. Paul Beckwith, on the other hand, who I just spoke to, seems to be a more cautious supporter of geoengineering in terms of the whole situation with the Arctic ice cap. I mean, if that ice melts in the next year or two, well, it is game over. I mean, we have no other option. What is you must have wrestled with this this problem yourself. What is your take on geoengineering?
Well, I too am skeptical of it. I wouldn't support it. I think, you know, bottom line, philosophically, using an industrial tool or a technical tool to solve a problem created by an industrial and technical tool is bound to fail. And certainly I read what some of the scientists themselves who are involved in coming up with these geoengineering tactics, and I quoted one of them in my last dispatch who referred to the science he was working on as, quote, terrifying. So, you know, when you've got the guys dividing the strategies themselves, calling it terrifying, this doesn't bode well. And I just don't see, you know, I think bottom line is nature is so complex and so intricate and so beyond our understanding, no matter how good our science is. And that comes directly from NASA scientists I've interviewed directly, you know, who say, look, what we've done is we've taken a sledgehammer to the climate of the planet. We don't even understand all the ramifications of what we've done. And then to think that you can all of a sudden show up at the, you know, at the last minute of the ball game and think that you're going to come up and use science to get us out of this is it just, you know, logically it just doesn't add up. So I don't think it's a good idea. I understand the impulse and I understand Paul Beckwith's position and some other scientists that I greatly respect their information and their intellect and their passion about what they're working on. And I understand that why they feel, look, you know, we can't let the Arctic melt. I agree. Like, I wish we could prevent it. But at this point, I think we're so far along that actually using geoengineering would only speed up what's already happening rather than really slow it down.
Okay, Darrell Chmiel, maybe one last question, since it's looking like you'll be probably my last interview for 2014. As you survey the climate situation, the geopolitical situation, are there any particular stories or developments that you are sort of having your eye on as we enter into 2015?
Yes, methane. I'm working on a series of articles now about how methane is already coming up out of the hydrates in the shallow shelves of Arctic, the Siberian Arctic, and being detected by NASA remote sensing satellites far out into the Arctic Ocean. So this is a huge story. It's ramping things up exponentially in regards to how fast things are progressing in regards to climate disruption. And so methane is kind of it's not really being addressed very much by the IPCC in those talks, and yet it's a greenhouse gas that in the first 20 years it's emitted is 100 times more potent than even CO2. So this is something that, again, most folks aren't really talking about, aren't really reporting, but it's definitely something I intend to be very attentive to and release several stories on in the next few weeks.
Well, Dar Chmiel, in spite of the rather sad and grim messaging, I really do appreciate having you on my program, and I very much appreciate your forthrightness and your diligence in continuing with the subject. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Thanks very much for that, and great to be on your show.
We've been speaking with Dar Chmiel, investigative journalist and staff reporter with Truth Out. An archive of Dar's articles are available at his website, darchmiel.net. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.